This is Radio Eco Shop with your host, Alex Smith.
How many times have we been told, even if we stop emissions today, Earth will continue warming for hundreds of years? Maybe that is not true. Maybe we can stop global warming in its tracks if we ever get to zero emissions. We investigate all that with the lead author of the study that offers a glint of hope. Dr. Andrew McDougall is the lead author of more than 16 peer-reviewed papers since 2008, which began well before his doctorate. Andrew is assistant professor at the Department of Climate and Environment at St. Francis Xavier University in Nova Scotia, Canada. From Antigonish, Andrew McDougall, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I have to start with a full disclosure. I read the paper published in Biogeosciences, and that's an open access journal. Anybody can find it. It's provided by the European Geosciences Union. And this paper has 29 authors from all over the world, and some have appeared on this program already. And still, with all that, I am not sure that I believe it. So let's get to work. Andrew, why did you apply for access to so many of the world's top climate models? How would you summarize the results from that 2020 paper?
So there is a fair amount of variability between the different models, but overall, the kind of multi-model mean is a zero change in temperature after emissions cease. So if you drop to emissions to zero, you wait 50 years. On average, the models have zero change in temperature. So basically, where you stop is where you stay. Now, the actual range is more like a cooling of about a third of a degree to about a warming of a third of a degree, and there's kind of lots of intricate details, but they average out to about zero.
So if we get to 3 degrees of warming over pre-industrial by the year 2100, which some scientists are warning is quite possible, this paper suggests that if we finally get our act together by then and there are no more fossil fuel burning and there's no more greenhouse gas emissions coming from humans, we would stay around the 3-degree level?
Roughly. So that also is for about 2 degrees of warming. So one of the things we did look at in the paper was different amounts of cumulative emissions. So there were 3 experiments, one with 750 billion tons, one with 1,000 billion tons, and one with 2,000 billion tons. And those roughly line up to 1.5, 2 degrees, and 3 degrees of warming. When you do go towards the higher end, towards 2,000 billion tons of carbon emitted, the tendency is for the models to have some more warming after emissions cease. So, for example, the UK Met Office model warms about 0.5 degree after about 3-ish degrees of warming. And same with the MUROC, the Japanese model. And then some of them still have a small amount of cooling. But as you go to higher and higher cumulative emissions, this where you stop, where you stay does appear to break down.
Well, that sounds a lot better than going to 4, 5, or 6 degrees, which a lot of people have kind of panicked about. Now, why did the reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change repeatedly predict centuries more warming, even if emission controls were successful?
So that's a related concept to zero emissions commitment, which is constant composition commitment. So what the earlier models did, and which they were only really capable of doing, is asking, okay, if we keep CO2 emissions at today's concentration, what will happen? And if you do that, then you do get continued warming for centuries, until the ocean comes into full equilibrium with the changed energy balance, and that takes a really long time. And so basically what's changed is we've changed the question to what if emissions go to zero? And then it's a question of, okay, what happens to the sinks? So right now, there's the 2 big sinks, the land carbon uptake and the ocean carbon uptake. And will these continue after emissions sink, or will they switch from a sink to a source? So the land is still extremely uncertain and complicated, but all of the models universally agree that the ocean will continue to take up carbon after emissions go to zero, which makes sense because it's still taking up heat, and the two processes are very closely linked.
Okay, I want to get to that in more detail in just a minute, but first, I'm just wondering how realistic the idea of zero emissions is. I mean, if a large part of our emissions comes from agriculture and we expect to feed billions more people, and we're really not on any sort of track towards zero emissions at the moment. Do you think it is possible at all? I mean, are we studying something that is kind of a thought experiment, or are we looking at real goals that governments have to take into account?
That is a very good point. The agriculture, so on the fossil fuel side, certainly I'm not terribly old, I'm 34, but in the kind of time I've been aware of these in the last, since I was in my mid-teens, the news has gotten better on the technology side in terms of, all right, can we get fossil fuel emissions down to zero? The agricultural emissions are more complicated, but the thing with the zero emissions commitment is we're really looking at CO2. And the other greenhouse gases, methane and N2O from agriculture predominantly, are quite different. And so with these shorter-lived gases, the warming you get depends more on the rate of emissions. So because a methane molecule only exists for about 10 years in the atmosphere before it reacts into CO2 and water, it's really the rate of emissions that counts. So the amount of warming you get from agriculture basically comes down to how many, you know, rice paddies and cows you have, and of course the N2O flux from the nitrogen fertilizers. So if you stabilize those emissions, you would stabilize the warming from agriculture, assuming you don't cut down a bunch of forests and turn them into agricultural land, which is what is happening in, you know, the Amazon.
So one possible objection concerns, as one 2020 paper put it, self-sustained melting of permafrost, even if all man-made greenhouse gas emissions stop in 2020. And that was based on a study published in Nature by Jorgen Randers and Ulrich Goluck. And Penn State's Michael Mann was one of several scientists who discounted that work. Andrew McDougall, I know you got your doctorate with a paper on permafrost thaw. Will it continue even if we rein in our emissions?
Yes. So if emissions go to zero and temperature does roughly stabilize, permafrost will continue to thaw and the organic matter that's in that permafrost will continue to decay and release carbon to the atmosphere. So if we look at kind of the lower end emission scenarios, we're talking about probably about order of 50 billion tons of carbon released in the 21st century, and then more thereafter. And this does play into the zero emissions commitment work, because only one of the models that participated in the study accounted for permafrost carbon, which was the model I helped develop in my PhD. But the permafrost feedback is big, but it's slow. So it's more like a glacier than a forest. So you hit it, and it begins to respond, and then it's kind of slowly leaching carbon out of these soils for hundreds and thousands of years. But at a rate that's on the kind of order of half a billion tons to a billion tons of emissions, which is roughly similar to kind of modern land use change emissions. So only about 10% at maximum of our current fossil fuel emissions.
Well, that matches what I'm finding from another paper published in Environmental Research Letters, and it's about subsea permafrost carbon stocks and an expert assessment of how fast they will come out. But there is a whole crew of people who are concerned about methane coming out of Siberia from the Siberian shelf under the sea, that it might leak into the atmosphere for centuries. What is your assessment of the Arctic methane threat from under the sea?
So that's one of the big questions, and probably the most vulnerable of the kind of methane pools in the Arctic is this subsea permafrost. So for those who know a bit about permafrost but not about this, it's a little bit confusing, but basically in the last glacial maximum, there is this area that had a lot of permafrost, and then it got flooded when the glaciers melted and sea levels rose. So you have this part of the Arctic shelf off the coast of Russia that has permafrost below the ocean. And the reason it continues to exist is because the seawater is actually below freezing. Because seawater is salty, it freezes slightly below 0 degrees Celsius. Because the permafrost is freshwater, it melts at zero. Kind of modern warming and the removal of sea ice, that ocean is warming up, that permafrost has begun to thaw, and there does appear to be some observational evidence that methane is coming out of that. Now, the thing is, it's hard to make methane come out really fast and everywhere at once. So this idea that there's going to be like a big, large plume of methane coming out doesn't really make sense. But you could have a long leak of it, and then it's a matter of, okay, how much of this will get into the atmosphere? Because there's this whole class of microorganisms called methanotrophs that actually eat methane. And some of them live in the ocean. And much of that methane might never make it into the atmosphere. So it's a complicated problem involving subsea permafrost, the geology, and then the oceanography, and then the biological oceanography. So it's definitely a problem that people are going to have to work on for a long time, but I don't think there's any plausible way to get enough methane out of there that would equal like our current fossil fuel methane output.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Canadian scientist Andrew McDougall, and he led a study showing Earth may not keep on warming if we can get our emissions totally under control. Let's talk about the timing assumed in the models that you ran. When did the period of zero emissions start? And then you looked at what might happen 50 years after that?
So the experiment we ran in this wasn't a particularly realistic one. It's what's called the 1% experiment, and this is where CO2 concentration in the atmosphere goes up at 1% a year and then kind of grows exponentially. So this experiment was developed in the 80s when they had really clunky computers for the very first computer models, and it's become this benchmark experiment that every climate model does. And there were a few reasons to pick this experiment. Simple one was we were really late into the IPCC process to try to get this model into comparison project going. And so all the modeling groups had already done this one, so they could start our experiment from what they'd already done. So it wasn't as much computer resources. But one of the problems of this experiment is you ramp up CO2 much faster than has been the historical observation. So we're cutting emissions off 60, 70 years into this experiment. So certainly in the kind of next generation of this intercomparison project, we want to do kind of more realistic scenarios following the historical trajectory and also do the non-CO2 greenhouse gases and aerosols as well. But the thing with the kind of cumulative emissions framework and the TCRE work that's been done in the carbon budgets is it really shouldn't matter very much how quickly you emit carbon, only the cumulative total. So we would think that this would be fairly similar to what happened in the more realistic experiments, which does roughly correspond to papers that have done more realistic experiments.
But, Andrew, what happens if we cross one or several of those tipping points that scientists talk about, or we get cascading tipping points, as recently suggested, before nations struggle to the point of zero emissions? Perhaps big natural cycles will be irreversible by then, and so how would we ever get to zero emissions?
So the zero emissions we're talking about is fossil fuel emissions. So that's entirely under human control. I mean, obviously it's a huge political project, to completely replace all of this infrastructure and reform our society to get to the point where we can get to zero fossil fuel emissions. And then we do have to worry about these natural feedbacks. And, I mean, that's the reason these Earth system models were developed in the first place, was to look at first these carbon cycle feedbacks, and as they grow more realistic and more complex, these other feedbacks. Part of what we're finding is the timescales we look at. And so a lot of these kind of feedbacks that you would expect to cascade into the future and, you know, bring Earth into a warm state like it had been before the present glaciations, that these feedbacks act more on geological timescales than human timescales. So, for example, the feedback I know best, the permafrost carbon feedback, you're talking about a system that's going to release carbon over several thousand years. So it's really slow compared to the current human emissions. And it's similar with glaciers, which I did my master's degree on glaciology. And you hit Antarctica and Greenland with warming, and they're going to keep melting for a really long time. But those changes are so much slower than the modern changes we're causing with fossil fuel emissions that the kind of first priority must be to get the fossil fuel emissions under control. And we'll worry about the rest of that when we get there.
Assuming we get there. So Dr. James Hansen, formerly a leading scientist at NASA, one of the most famous climate scientists, has been publishing about Earth energy imbalance for years. He suggests there could be up to a degree of warming hidden by air pollution, among other things, and we can measure the imbalance. How does that fit into your findings of a climate that could stabilize itself more or less?
Yes, so there definitely is. So if you remove all the air pollution, you would get a warming effect. So currently, air pollution, mostly sulfates, but a few other nasty gases, have this effect where they brighten clouds and also directly reflect sunlight away, and so they counteract part of the warming. So if you stop emitting those, you would get a warm-up effect, which is sometimes called the aerosol shock. But on the other side, we have these short-lived greenhouse gases that counteract either some of that or more of that. It's quite uncertain how the magnitudes will match up. But if you reduce your methane emissions from fossil fuels, the methane concentration will relatively quickly drop off and counteract at least part of that warming. And then the other one, big one, the black carbon. So you have emissions of literally soot that go into the atmosphere. They land on snow. They make snow darker and have a warming effect. Well, if you get rid of your coal-fired power plants, which make your sulfate emissions, you also get rid of your black carbon. In the past, it's been said that these roughly cancel out, whether it's exactly or just the same kind of order of magnitude, that there will be some cancellation. So if you did a more kind of realistic experiment where all of these different forcings went to zero over time, then you might get some warming or some cooling, depending basically on whether the methane effect is bigger or the aerosol effect is bigger.
Now, studying deep time, we find this planet has been in a hotter state for much longer periods than the Ice Age times where humans appeared. And eminent scientists like Joachim Schellenhuber worry Earth will warm beyond 4 degrees, setting off all kinds of feedback effects. I gather your study doesn't discount the possibility of going into a hothouse Earth. Am I right?
No, but if you enter a hothouse Earth state, it would take a very long time to get there. Those studies, of course, are well supported in that through most of Earth's history through deep time, Earth has been in a hothouse state. It's one of the kind of two basic stable states, a climate system where you have either no ice or all ice. So if you want to move towards, well, we don't want to, but if you were to move towards a hothouse state, you need to remove the ice caps. So you need to get rid of Greenland and Antarctica, which is going to take a long time. And then you're going to have to reconfigure the ocean circulation. So we're not going to have the deep water formation sites in the North Atlantic and along the Antarctic coast anymore. And so that's going to take another few thousand years to rearrange the ocean. These processes take a long time. And then it's also an open kind of question on the geological side of, okay, like what's the ultimate cause of our current colder state over millions of years? Is it the rise of the Himalayas? Is it the mountain building in kind of the Indonesian area? And what sets this kind of balance of CO2 over geological time? But if you're thinking on kind of a human perspective, like 10,000 years out into the future, that these things are going to happen relatively slowly.
Well, that's slightly more hopeful. We can stall off doom for thousands of years. Maybe humans will figure out a solution. So, as you mentioned earlier, your study does depend on the land and ocean sinks for soaking up the extra carbon and leveling us off or maybe even cooling us a little bit. But I have to say, I just interviewed Dr. Catherine Duffy from Northern Arizona University, and she led the study titled, How Close Are We to the Temperature Tipping Point of the Terrestrial Biosphere? And essentially, she argued that when we reach the upper limit of land plants, they become a source of carbon in the atmosphere rather than capturing it into a sink. And Susan Natale told us something similar, that the winter Arctic's already producing more greenhouse gases than are being absorbed by plants in the northern summer. So what happens to your models if the land sinks decline and become carbon sources instead?
So that does actually happen in a lot of the models. All of these models have a land component. How realistic they are is, of course, open to question. But they do have different plant function types, which are stimulating the plants, taking up carbon, and the soils, which when you get warmer, soil carbon decays faster, goes back into the atmosphere. And so many of the models in the results of the paper are pretty close to that transition point. And a lot of the variability in whether you get a little bit of cooling or a little bit of warming depends on how strong that residual land sink or transition to a land source is. The part of it that's much more predictable and stable is the prediction of continued uptake by the ocean.
Andrew, you and your team got access to some of the world's biggest climate models, and there's a lot of demand on them. Why is it so important to know the possible results of zero emissions?
The key for zero emissions is trying to get this concept of a carbon budget nailed down. So a finite amount of carbon, fossil fuels that you can burn over all of time and stay below some temperature guardrail. So usually the Paris targets of 1.5 or 2 degrees. And to make this system make sense, you need to know how much warming you'll get if you do go to zero emissions. So if you want to know how much fossil fuels you can burn over all time, you need to account for the warming that would happen in the future if there was any.
I wonder if these model results will help us as kind of a shining goal, a kind of prize we can hope for if we make those wrenching changes to get off fossil fuels. Is that how you see it?
Yes. So when I do public presentations, my kind of three main points I try to kind of tell the general public to update them, you know, kind of what we've learned since An Inconvenient Truth, is that warming is approximately proportional to cumulative emissions of CO2, so total amount of fossil fuels we burn. Where we stop is roughly where we stay. So once you stop burning fossil fuels, you will roughly stay at those temperatures. And then where you stay, you're going to stay for a very long time. So when we take some of these models, the intermediate complexity ones, and run them 10,000 years out into the future, you get very little cooling. Once you reach that plateau, you're kind of stuck there. And even if you were to do negative emissions with technology that doesn't exist and may never exist, once heat gets into the ocean, there's no easy way to get it out. Where you stop is where you stay.
Worth remembering. Andrew McDougall, you have a good record of leading scientific teams and publishing, especially for a relatively young scientist. What are the big questions you would like to tackle?
So, I mean, that's a hard one. Probably should start thinking of it because I need to renew my grants pretty soon.
Well, what are you working on now? Let's put it that way.
So I'm still working on zero emissions commitment work. So we kind of got this stuff done really quickly before the IPCC deadlines, but we haven't really looked at the 3D results yet. So if the model overall averages zero change in temperature, is that true for land versus ocean, tropics, extratropics? So I want to dig deeper into those kind of intricacies. I'm still interested in developing these Earth system models further. So I have one of my PhD students who's adding phosphorus to the kind of climate model I worked on as a PhD student. And so getting more of these biogeochemical cycles to try to get a better realistic representation of the Earth system, the best we can get. Kind of still interested in these broader Earth system questions of, like, if we look into deep time, you know, why are we in this ice house state in the first place? And basically, will there be another ice age in the future, given what we've already done to the Earth system? And so I'm getting more interested in these bigger, longer-term questions, probably the more time I'm in a relatively small university talking to geologists a lot.
Well, I'm going to put links to your work page and your CV in my show blog at ecoshock.org, and I'll toss in links to all the science we've talked about. Is there any other web page or Twitter feed or something where people can follow your work?
I do have a Twitter handle. I'm not very active. I was pretty reluctant to sign up to Twitter, but it had to be done in the end. So if I do publish papers, I do put my stuff out there.
I will track down your Twitter feed and toss that in my blog as well. We've been talking about the paper, Is There Warming in the Pipeline? A Multi-Model Analysis of the Zero Emissions Commitment from CO2 from St. Francis Xavier University in Nova Scotia, Canada. We've been speaking with the lead author, Dr. Andrew McDougall. Andrew, thank you for helping us to understand here on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.